Welcome to Brothers in Song, everyone, the podcast that pioneered podcasts by brothers. We walked so the Kelsey brothers could run, I believe.
Well, I'll take credit for it if they want to give us credit for it. That's fine with me. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you, Joe?
I'm good. Getting into the holiday spirit, you know. It's a busy time of year, but glad we get this one in. Because I think it's a really good one, in my humble opinion, because it was my choice. So, what's going on in your neck of the woods?
Well, I just came back from a trip to Seattle not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Home of grunge, most famously, for better or worse. But that was a big part of my youth and a little bit of your youth as well. So got to luxuriate in that a little bit. Went to the Pop Culture Museum, which was pretty great. And if you're a music fan, you should definitely check that out if you happen to be in Seattle. They happened to have a big Nirvana exhibit going on at the time.
Oh, wow.
So it's just good timing there. Also celebrating 50 years of hip hop. So there was a big exhibit for that. And they just have a whole bunch of cool stuff where I was just sitting there like, how did you get the Cowardly Lion costume from The Wizard of Oz? Like, seriously. And all kinds of stuff like that where you're like, man, how did you get that one? You know? but it was a fun trip.
Man, the world of museum acquisitions is a crazy one. So I'm sure there's lots of fun stories about how they got that stuff, but it sounds like a really cool place. I've never been to the Pacific Northwest, but it's certainly some place I'd like to explore someday. So I can sense from your just overall comments, it's a solid endorsement from you that it's a good place to go see. Yeah.
Yeah. Seattle's a good city. It's very manageable for a visit, I would say. A bit on the expensive side, but most cool cities are. Yeah. But yeah, had some good food. They've got great museums and culture, and actually wish I had an extra day or two.
Awesome. Well, just a reason to go back to check out those few spots you didn't get to on this trip. So that's always got a little leave a little meat on the bone, you know. So let's get to it. Our topic at hand tonight. So this is my choice, and tonight we'll be discussing the 1955 album by Francis Albert Sinatra, In the Wee Small Hours. But before we get into it, the album art for this just struck me. As I was pulling it up, and you know, even for that time, I think it was kind of avant-garde and really pretty cool. So before we get into talking about the music, I'd love to hear your thoughts on some of your favorite album art that you've seen over the years.
Sure. Yeah, there's so much, and I kind of just had to pick three that just stood out to me immediately as of today. But I'm sure we could do an entire episode on album art.
Yeah, probably.
Which might be a good idea for the future. So here are my three examples of things that I like. Mm-hmm. So if you follow us on Instagram, you know that a little while back I went to a concert from a band that I like called Sleep Token. Their first album, full-length album, is called Sundowning, and it's an extremely minimalistic cover. It's just all white, and these vertical bars of black fading into gray. So it's just like an abstract minimalist sort of thing that is, I guess, a bit mysterious and doesn't really reveal, you know, what you're about to to hear. And I tend to like album covers like that, you know.
Another one that it's just so common for people just to have a like some image of themselves on it. So when it's not that, it kind of throws you for a loop, you know?
Although my next example does have a picture of the artist on the front.
That's
and
right.
That is the and that is the album cover for the Eurythmics album Touch. And it's just Annie Lennox from the shoulders up, sort of in profile, maybe more towards like a three-quarter view of her. And she's wearing like a black mask, like a Lone Ranger type mask. And she's got like her really short, bright orange hair that she had in the 80s. And she's just like looking very, just very intense and like looking at the viewer of the album in like sort of a confrontational way. And you can barely read the album title because the lettering is all wonky. So I just like how it's aggressively weird. And I love Annie Lennox. So I think that just kind of like exemplifies her being like the iconoclastic person that she was.
Oh, for sure.
And then my last example is the Sigur Rós album Talk. Sigur Rós, for those of you who don't know, is an Icelandic group that produces these really lush, many times very long songs that perhaps could only be made by people from Iceland. but they're just very cinematic and cool songs. But as far as the album cover for this particular one goes, it's kind of like this sepia tone background. You know, it kind of looks like a stained piece of paper, like a weathered beaten piece of paper, and there's trees and a figure that look like they were just drawn in ink with a brush. And so there's like, so some parts of it are more well defined than others. It's figurative but also kind of abstract, but it looks like handmade, which I think is pretty cool.
Well, those all sound like three really cool choices. I think you're right. This might be a future episode for us because I think there's many memorable album covers that, you know, you can picture it in your mind when you hear the music, you know, because it's just so indelible and linked to that music. And I really like this cover because, you know, it has that noir feel to it. It does have Frank Sinatra on it, but just the way it's set, it just kind of it gives you a sense of what you're in for when you put this record on, in the best possible way. And it just it totally mimics the whole feel and style of the music on this album. And I think it was an excellent choice. And if anybody's looking for any last minute Christmas gifts for me, I would love to have an LP of that frame, just because I think it'd look cool on the wall.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, it simultaneously looks exactly like Frank Sinatra, but if it wasn't one of his album covers, like it could be anybody and it would still be a cool piece of art.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get into it. This is my choice, and I have been a Frank Sinatra fan for a very, very long time. And, you know, I've gone through phases where I've listened to a lot of his earlier stuff. And this is kind of mid-career, you know, a midpoint in his career, that this particular album. And it comes out really at a crossroads, both in his life and his career. But I didn't know how much you had really listened to Frank Sinatra, so I thought this would be a good one for us to listen to closely together. And in doing my research, you know, this comes out in 1955, and a lot of folks consider this one of the first concept albums, which is a topic we have touched on numerous times on this pod. And, you know, to his credit, you know, just putting this thing together, certainly you hear the unity of all the themes of all the different pieces, but really up until this point, when folks were putting together albums, they're really just putting together singles, and there wasn't necessarily a need for a linkage between each track. It was just like, all right, do we have enough for an LP front and back? Great. Let's record it in 3 days. Let's print it. Let's make some money and let's move on. But I think there's just so much thought, care, and detail put into this. And again, in doing some of the research, this is really, I think, his artistic response to his failed relationship with Ava Gardner. And, you know, you certainly can hear that throughout the album. And just, you know, the way that it's, you know,
but we have a guest appearance on the podcast today, I guess.
Well, I can go back. And there was just so much thought and care put into this, I think, both by Frank Sinatra and also Nelson Riddle, who was the conductor and the arranger of many of these pieces. And really, you can hear his fingerprints all over this thing, too, in the best possible way. I certainly knew some of the tracks on this album, but had never listened to it all the way through. I don't think you had either, Dan. So what's been your relationship with Frank throughout your life? You know, he's an old friend to me, but I don't know how much time you spent listening to him.
Well, I've spent a little bit. I remember in college, I picked up a random Frank Sinatra collection that I would listen to once in a while. The things I most remember from that CD were the coffee song, which I always thought was kind of humorous, and the song Autumn in New York. He does a version of that on that particular random collection. I mean, I've always liked Frank Sinatra, but I don't think I've ever really thought a lot about it. You know, again, he's another one of these American icons, like, you know, a Dolly Parton, who we did an episode on, or Johnny Cash, or Willie Nelson, or, you know, any one of these American icons in music that you just sort of, you know what they sound like, but you just sort of take them for granted. Mm. And that's always been my experience with Frank Sinatra. And throughout this podcast, I think we've done a good job of finding artists like that. Simon and Garfunkel is another one. And if you kind of strip away that icon status and you start listening to them for what they truly are and for what they're truly trying to do as artists, and you gain an appreciation for how they became icons in the first place, you know, so for that reason, I think it's good that we, you know, take a look at Frank Sinatra for sure.
Yeah, because I think for a lot of people, you know, depending on your age and, you know, what you listen, like, it could get to the point where it's almost like a caricature of the person themselves, because they're just so ubiquitous throughout our pop culture. And if you do take a step back and really listen closely and dive deeply into what they've created, I think that more often than not, you're going to find out that there's some real substance behind that image. And that's what was made them so compelling and had such a loyal following for so long. And I think this is true of Frank Sinatra and a lot of the other people that you mentioned. For me, that's always fun to go back and listen to that, because you're like, oh yeah, he was so good. He was so smooth. Mm-hmm. And I tried to pick one that was a little bit earlier in his career. And this is probably like kind of in the middle. He had just moved over to Capitol Records and started that partnership and, you know, to great success. But that wasn't necessarily a guarantee when they signed him to that contract, because he was kind of fading out of his like sort of teeny bopper phase, and he was already sort of a young adult, and people just weren't sure what to do with him. So then he's like, here, I'll just create this masterpiece, and this is what you can do with me. And just a funny coincidence. So this came out in 1955. He also starred in Guys and Dolls with Marlon Brando in 1955. So if things were on the rocks a little bit or had the potential to go off the rails, I think he made some good choices in 1955 to get him back to being chairman of the board, so to speak.
Yeah, and I can't believe when you asked me like what my experience with Frank Sinatra was, like, I can't believe I didn't mention the movie version of Guys and Dolls.
Oh yeah.
For some reason, like in our house growing up, we were all into that movie. Like our sister was into that movie. I was into that movie. I loved a lot of the songs.
Pete didn't really have a choice.
Yeah. Yeah, our youngest sibling didn't really have a choice. That was another experience I had with Frank Sinatra as a younger person.
Yeah. So with this album, I mean, we touched a little bit on the scene. You know, it's heartache, it's longing, it's breakup, it's being alone. But I'm curious, you know, the themes of that permeates throughout. You know, there's 16 tracks, which is a pretty long album for this time period. What were some of the ones that really stood out for you?
Well, there were a few. And just as kind of a general comment leading into the songs that I liked, I think one of the things that I was most struck by listening to this is just the level of control and mastery he has over his vocal instruments. You know, and although he's not working with like a huge range, that's not really, you know, that's not really the point. It's like the point is like just the control and the expressiveness he has, you know. And I don't want to sound like elitist here, but like it's maybe something you can't fully understand unless you've tried to sing yourself. And just the way he's able to put together those phrases, and with the breath control and the control over his dynamics and all of that. And I'm just going to like keep going back to that as I talk about this, I think.
No, that's exactly right. And it's hard to ignore. And the two things that always stick out to me, and it's, you know, through his entire career, is such pure vowels, which I think is a necessity based on what he wants to do artistically. And the phrasing that you mentioned, the word I was going to use is, he just has such great sense of line, and he knows exactly where the destination is. And what I think, without having sort of this virtuosic vocal instrument, what keeps people interested is that he doesn't always take the straight line to the destination. He always meanders. He always takes an unexpected turn or does something that you wouldn't always think of, you know, because again, in 1955, pop singers were very, a lot of them were very straightforward in their approach, and, you know, they were just making a beautiful sound with their voice. And he really took the time to tell a story, not only through the lyrics, but through his music making. And that's not an easy thing to do, you know, really in any style or genre of music. And I especially like it on this because, yes, there's some orchestration around it, but ultimately his voice is the main event. And again, Nelson Riddle just created so much space for that to happen. That again, it's hard to ignore. And that's really why I think, you know, he has endured, and it's because of the way he can tell a story with his voice.
Right, right. And, you know, to get into the songs, which ultimately was your question.
Yeah. Well, we were going to get to the voice at some point, so might as well start off with it, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, and it starts with the title track, and, you know, I've said this before about music of the past and how this music is really about the melody instead of the rhythm like we have today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the opening track, it's just a perfect example of that. Like you were saying, the notes that he's singing, they just go places that you wouldn't expect, and it's just so difficult to do. And I'm not going to sing it because I want people to listen to it, and you know, and I wouldn't do it justice off the cuff like this. But in the opening track, in the Wee Small Hours, there's the line, "And I never ever think of counting sheep." And he's kind of in his lower register, and then he kind of just like bobs up to this note in counting, in the word counting. And it's such like an unexpected interval. And he's so smooth, you hardly even notice it, but it is weird to just like go from where he was and then jump up like that. And it's just so hard to like hit all those notes and like not make a mistake, because it's not going to the place where you're expecting it to go, but it just like fits the piece so well.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree with everything you said, and again, the way that he takes those turns, there's little, you know, grace notes or appoggiaturas. And I should know this because, Dan, God knows, I've watched enough, like, Frank Sinatra behind-the-scenes documentaries, etc. Yeah. And I don't know how much of that was, like, in the moment, improvised, or if it was, like, painfully rehearsed. I think it's probably somewhere in the middle where he would take the time to, you know, learn the music and think how he could make it his own, even if he's, you know, altering things here and there. But I also think he was certainly somebody who was spontaneous and in the moment would try to do things and, you know, take some risks and see how it would play out. And, you know, this was a track I was certainly familiar with, but I hadn't listened to it in years. So it was really nice to, you know, listen to it again. And sometimes in prepping for these, you know, you start at the beginning because that's just the easiest place to start when you pull it up and you start listening. So I got to listen to the beginning part of this one a lot, which was kind of nice in prepping for this one. What were some other ones that sort of stuck out for you that were maybe a little bit less familiar to both you and the audience?
Well, maybe my favorite song on the album was Deep in a Dream. I usually don't expect to be to be too interested or have too much of a focal point on the lyrics in music from this era. And I'm not trying to disparage the songwriters, but it's just like not the type of lyrics that are going to like really blow me away, I guess, based on what I'm interested in. But I just love the description of the room, the speaker of the song talking about sitting in the room by himself and the cigarette smoke climbing through the air, and the vocal line ascends in such a way to be evocative of the cigarette smoke. I love it when there's that type of connection between the music and the content of the song, and you know, Sinatra understands this perfectly, and he sings it perfectly, and it's just and it's just relaxed, and his voice is like imitating cigarette smoke somehow. you know
yeah.
if you sit and listen to it, you'll know what I mean.
Yeah Well, I really like Deep in a Dream as well. And another one, Glad to Be Unhappy, is I like the opening because it's kind of a little bit it's a little bit like he's, you know, just kind of talking at you, not really singing, and it really evokes like that, the way that they set that up in musicals or in opera. And then it really gets into the bulk of the song. You know, and there's very much sort of this like introductory melody, but then eventually it meanders back to, you know, kind of a chorus that you, and a refrain that you get familiar with. But for me, I think I Get Along Without You very well. That one was just like silky, silky smooth for me. And I'm glad you commented a little bit about the songwriting, because obviously Frank Sinatra is not a prolific songwriter. So there's, you know, several folks that worked on the music of this album. But I was also struck by the sophistication of the lyrics, because, again, for music of this era, it's sometimes almost an afterthought. It's really about the melody first and the tune, and that's really what's driving the creation, the creative process of a lot of these songs. And then they just kind of, you know, add the lyrics and make it work, and it's great. But this one, there were a couple of lyrics where I was just like, wow. And I've got it pretty bad, but for someone you adore, it's a pleasure to be sad. I was like, yeah, that's smooth. That's just so smooth.
Yeah. And when that person happens to be Ava Gardner, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, if you screw that up, you're not going to be too happy with yourself.
No. So I really that was probably my favorite. I mean, there's lots of good ones, but those certainly were highlights for me. I gotta ask you, I was curious if you picked up on it as well. But Mood Indigo and Ill Wind, those seem like very different from the others. And I'm not gonna say that I dislike them. I probably just like other things more. But I was curious if, one, you had the same thought of these two things being, you know, straying away from the general sound of the album, because they are a little bit more jazzy, or if those two sort of, what were your impressions of those, if they really stuck out to you in any meaningful way?
Yeah, I mean, I guess now that you mention it, they are a little bit different, and I did kind of notice it with Mood Indigo. That's a Duke Ellington song. So it is going to have, you know, more of a jazz influence. You know, it's going to be different types of chord progressions and stuff like that. So, you know, I didn't really mind it. I just I just didn't really mind.
Mm-hmm.
They were fine by me, and you know, maybe we'll get into this a little bit later, but I feel like I could have used a little more variety along those lines. I did notice a difference. For sure. Even though it was the same subject matter, it's kind of the same the same sort of pacing of the song, but it was different from a harmonic perspective, I guess, if I may be so bold as to say.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're absolutely right about that. No, I agree. And I bring it up not that I think it was, you know, because I don't think there's going to be a whole lot for us to, you know, comment negatively about much of this. But those two definitely felt different, and it's not good or bad. It just took me a while to get used to it, because it was a little bit different from what the rest of the album sort of sounds like.
Right, for sure. For sure. As long as we are on the subject of critiques, may I offer a critique or two?
Carefully. You sure can.
Yeah. No, very carefully. I mean, far be it from me. You know, and any critique that I would have with this is going to be more related to, like, my personal taste and listening habits. I'm not going to be coming up with any, like, aesthetic arguments or definitely not critiquing the craftsmanship of this in any sort of way. Because I did enjoy this quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I also feel that perhaps if I'm having like a Frank Sinatra itch that I need to scratch, mm-hmm. and I want the ballads and the type of atmosphere that this album provides, I feel like that can be satisfied by around like 35-ish minutes of this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously, like you said, it's kind of a proto-concept album to have all these types of songs together. But as you're fond of saying, I could have used some sort of palate cleanser in there, you know, particularly from like the perspective of tempo. You know, nothing too crazy, but maybe just something a little different to, you know, to break things up. Because I think that when you have so many songs that are so similar, it's like the back half of the album gets short shrift because you listen to the front of it, and then by the time you get to the back, it's like you're accustomed to, you know, that type of sound. So it makes it more difficult to, you know, to judge things on the back half of the album, because you're already kind of saturated with you know, the mood that the album is creating.
So I thought I was gonna maybe land in a similar spot, because mm-hmm. I saw like how many tracks were on the full album, and again, for 1955, this is pretty long, right? Because they usually mm-hmm. had around 40 minutes, because of the front and back, or the space limitations is just on the front and the back of the record. And this one's 50, just about 50. But here's the thing, is I said that I thought I was going to have that experience, and then I kept listening to it, and I was not mad that it kept going on and on and on, and you kind of find yourself getting lost in it.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's kind of like, well, if this is the mood that you're in and you want to, you know, have some experience with those emotions, like, this will get you there, for better or worse. But if you're just kind of like, I just need some Frank in my life to kind of chill out and relax, then probably the first, you know, I don't know, 2/3, 3/4 of this album will get that job done.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said, I'm just speaking to my personal listening habits. Like, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with this, and I think that they accomplished their goal very well. And also, maybe I just had to think of something to say that wasn't just fawning and loving this thing. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, obviously his voice is so good. And I think if you're a singer, no matter what genre you're singing in, like, listen to this a few times and then try singing along with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And holding out those notes and like doing those delicate decrescendos at the end and stuff. And you may find yourself thinking, I got to take some voice lessons and like work on my breath control, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's just the control, I think, is the key point, right? Because mm-hmm. he's just in such command of the entire thing. And he's in charge and you know it. And mm-hmm. you're totally happy about that that scenario.
Right. Right. And, you know, we've obviously praised Sinatra a lot, and it is his album. But again, like a lot of stuff from this era, I think we talked about this on the Nat King Cole episode. You gotta give credit to the orchestra.
Yeah.
Because like all these people are gone from planet Earth most likely, and they didn't get any credit and probably got paid nothing. And they just completely killed it. And, yeah. you know, and this might be a good transition into my final thoughts, which is like, when you listen to this stuff, I think it is important to keep in mind that this is all this stuff is one take. Everybody's in a room, you know, I don't know how many people, and they're just completely locked in, dialed in. Time is money. If you were making mistakes, Frank was probably yelling at you. You know what I mean? You know,
yeah, he was.
You know, so you just really have to give these people credit for their labor, which goes uncredited. So
yeah, absolutely, because you know, if Frank Sinatra is making these vocal choices with his phrasing and his and just his interpretation of some of these classics, and the orchestra isn't responsive to that, then it's not bad, but it's certainly not as great as it is here. And you know, that's really true music making, and it's hard to do, and it's hard to do, you know, with a lot of people like that. But when it happens, it's great. And again, like you know, I feel like we've touched on this, but I don't know a whole lot of people who could pull something like this off today. I don't even know what the equivalent of that would be like, but maybe we don't need somebody to try to recreate this in their own way, because it's pretty damn great on its own.
For sure. And, you know, when I say stuff like this, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, criticize the musicians of today, because God knows if musicians in the 50s had the same technological advances that we have now, they most certainly would have used them. I'm sure they would have preferred not to spend you know, all the time doing take after take and rehearsing and you know, all that stuff to get this right. You know, so I'm not saying that they're like more virtuous than musicians of today, but it is something that you need to take note of, because you need to appreciate just how much more difficult it was and how dedicated they were for doing it.
Yeah, it's great. And we're, you know, we're lucky to be in a time and place where we get to experience both things. Like, people can literally make, you know, really great music with a telephone now. And, you know, we can always look back to the past and see how great things were back then because of the challenges that they faced trying to create them. So it's all good stuff.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that.
So I think we're still in the planning stages for 2024. I don't know if we'll get another one in before the end of the year.
Well, I would like to do a little bit of end of the year wrap up.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to try and get that out for you people. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that we're going to do it.
All right. Well, you said it. It's true. So let's get to work.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's kind of crazy that we're moving into like our, I guess, like our third holiday season ish
mm-hmm.
with this podcast, you know, approaching our third anniversary in just a few more months.
Mm-hmm.
So as our gift to you, we're gonna try and get you another high quality episode before the end of 2023. Any other final thoughts before we go, Joe?
No, I hope you enjoyed this one. I certainly did. And I know you have some good ideas for our upcoming ones. So looking forward to diving into those with you as well.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
Brothers in Song is written and produced by Joseph Collin and Daniel Collin, and edited by Daniel Collin. To keep up with the latest news, follow us on Instagram at Brothers in Song. Until next time, listen to some new music. You just may surprise yourself.